recommendations on screening for osteoporosis.
Using an artificial pancreas to control sugar in hospitalized patients.
Can we care for patients successfully at home with acute illness?
And exploiting a virus to treat brain cancer.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This will be posted on June 29th, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we start with the new USPSTF recommendations regarding screening for osteoporosis? These are published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And as we know, they take a look at these things periodically and say, do we need to modify them? What's really interesting is what's been going on with hip fractures. If we take a look at that data for older people, it shows that from 1986 to 1995, it increased, but then declined from 1995 to 2012. Since then, those hip fracture rates have plateaued at levels that were higher than projected in 2013 to 2015. So there's an estimated 3,700 additional hip fractures per year. So this is really important because we've talked about so many times on the podcast, there's really a solid line relationship between hip fracture, subsequent surgery, and death in older folks. So we know that osteoporosis, of course, is the underlying problem with this. So the USPSTF took a look at the data and said, all right, women who are age 65 and older should be screened with bone measurement tests, DEXA scans in general, to take a look at, hey, do you have osteoporosis or osteopenia? That's a grade B recommendation. For younger women, other screening tools, and there's several of them that could be employed, could also be used. And then if they detect a potential problem, still we're going to go to a screening, an actual bone measurement density. And then a little disappointingly with regard to men, because we know that also older men suffer from osteoporosis, they don't have a recommendation. They say there's not enough data.
This is an update from the 2011 USPSTF recommendations. It's pretty clear in women that a bone mineral density determination at age 65 or younger, if a woman has risk factors that suggest she has a high risk for osteoporosis, can be used to decide which women should undergo therapy to prevent worsening of the osteoporosis. Studies have shown that prevents hip fractures, but we don't have that similar data in men. And that's why they don't make a firm recommendation in men. Perhaps bone mineral density determination in men over the age of 70 or younger, if they are considered to be at high risk for osteoporosis, may be beneficial because we have some therapies that are beneficial in men at preventing the progression of osteoporosis. We just don't have any data that suggests they prevent hip fractures. That's the other recommendation. Once you've had it, how often do you need to have the next one? Well, that depends upon what your risks are and what your age is.
As time has gone on, I think we've seen some rather concerning aspects of calcium supplementation, vitamin D supplementation, bisphosphonates. So I guess, sure, it's great to be screened and it's great to know that this may prevent a hip fracture if you go on therapy, but I think we got some work to do there too.
They clearly highlight in the recommendations what therapies have been shown to be beneficial. And they also looked at harms. And other than deep vein thrombosis with bisphosphonates, there didn't seem to be significant harms associated with therapies that are recommended.
So if you're a woman over age 65, go get screened, sounds like.
Or a man over the age of 70.
Okay. From here, which one would you like to do?
Let's talk about the artificial pancreas for a moment. People that are diabetic, that are hospitalized, oftentimes have elevated sugars. And the routine way of doing that is to give episodic insulin doses after meals to try to keep the sugar down. Well, we now have what's called an artificial pancreas. We can actually record instantaneous sugar using a subcutaneously placed monitor. We can send that to a computer that has an algorithm that determines if you need insulin that can communicate wirelessly with a pump. Does all of this increased technology actually improve sugar control in hospitalized diabetic patients? It appears that it does. This was a study conducted in 136 adults in the United Kingdom and Switzerland who had type 2 diabetes and were hospitalized and needed to have insulin to control their sugar. Half of them got the routine care. Half of them got this artificial pancreas treatment. They looked at what percentage of the time they remained controlled, that is, their sugar was less than 180. And in those that had the artificial pancreas, it was controlled 66% of the time versus only 40% using the usual control. Did these people have a higher risk of adverse events, particularly hypoglycemia? And the answer was no.
For folks who already didn't have a pump, which it seems to me that at least a lot of people with type 2 diabetes are electing, and type 1 for that matter. How troublesome was it to actually use one?
This was a controlled setting. It was usually under 15 days, so it really wasn't an issue with these patients. That is, they were able to use the pump, and none of them had to take it off. Now, there were three pump malfunctions, and when that happens, it just shuts down, and they have to replace it.
This sounds to me like the kind of thing that someone would want to take home with them.
In this particular study, two-thirds of the type 2 diabetics were on home insulin, a third weren't. And we're trying to get away from using insulin whenever possible and treat it with oral agents. But you're right, in those that do need insulin, using artificial pancreas can be very beneficial.
Well, since we're talking about taking things home with you, let's transition to JAMA Internal Medicine. A look at whether patients who have a hospitalization then can be discharged with after their acute episode with 30 days of post-acute transitional care at home. This is a really attractive notion to me. And here at Hopkins, there's a lot of studies that are being undertaken about hospital at home. Gosh, can we avoid a lot of the things like infection risk and so forth if we just care for somebody at home rather than have them in the hospital? So in this case, they took a look at 507 patients. 507 were enrolled. Basically, they sent these folks home with someone who came in to see them every day and manage everything that was related to their care for 30 days after this acute episode. The upshot was that they showed that it was associated with better patient outcomes and ratings of their care compared with inpatient hospitalization. I think this is a really good news study, but you've got some concerns.
So Elizabeth, as you mentioned, these were people that presented to the emergency department and would normally have been admitted to the hospital and instead were given the option of receiving their care at home. They compared them to individuals who refused to have this type of therapy or presented to the emergency room on weekends or after hours when it wasn't available. So it's not a really very good comparison because you have a group that says, yes, I want to do this at home, and they're motivated to do so, and they're potentially less sick and better motivated for that care to be effective. Furthermore, this was done at a single center, so we can't extrapolate to a larger healthcare system. And it also has the possibility of being abused. If in fact this was adopted and paid for, easily a healthcare system or a physician could say, you know what, this patient could be treated as an outpatient, but I'm going to admit them as a hospital at home patient where I can receive a better payment for it.
Yeah. Per your point, though, about the ones who were hospitalized were sicker, this actually says that the hospital at home patients were older and more likely to have a pre-acute functional impairment. So it sounds to me like they may have been sicker, sort of chronically more ill than the folks who were actually admitted.
Well, when you dig a little deeper, the people at home were more likely to have a urinary tract infection. On the other hand, the people that got admitted were more likely to have congestive heart failure. It wasn't a randomized trial. Although these results are promising, they need to be confirmed in more rigorous, larger trials that, in fact, are randomized.
Okay, but I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that, you know, I think we're going to be talking more about this model. Let's turn now to something that was really quite interesting. The use of poliovirus to help treat glioblastoma, pretty terrible kind of a brain cancer, in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Why would, in fact, you use poliovirus? Remember, the poliovirus is neurotropic. It binds to receptors on nerve cells, and it may be uniquely suited to treat nerve, that is, brain cancers. What this study looked at is 61 patients who had recurrent glioblastoma, and they compared them to historical controls. And these 61 patients received a poliovirus that has been modified so it can't reproduce. We know that this poliovirus causes the death of the nerve cells and then elicits an immune response as well. 21% had a response.
And of course, this builds on other studies we've talked about relative to the utility of viruses to target very certain tissues and to carry things along that might actually be beneficial when they do so.
Absolutely. This is promising. Now, the real question is, only 20% of individuals responded. Is there a way to predict who will respond and who will not respond? Future studies should give us some insight into that.
As well as, is there a time at which it's most appropriate to use the virus for treatment?
Absolutely. This was actually a dose-ranging study. They used different doses to try to determine what was safe and most effective. But you're right, Elizabeth. The next questions are, should it be administered early? Because these were all recurrent glioblastomas. And also, what's the role of your innate immunity? These individuals all received a polio vaccination beforehand to rev their immune system up. And are there ways we can supplement the use of this virus to receive even better results?
On that note, gosh, it's really hard to decide which of these is the most interesting thing to talk about. I'm going to let you decide.
I'd like to highlight the treatment of the glioblastoma with the poliovirus.
Okay, that sounds great. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.